Welcome to today's SNEB webinar. Very excited about today's presentation, talking about the most recent position paper that SNEB has authored in the January issue of the Journal of Nutrition Education and Behavior. So my name is Rachel Dager. I'm the Executive Director of SNEB. And to get us started with some housekeeping, if you look in the GoToWebinar tool panel, you'll see the handouts for today's presentation, the slides that the authors have kindly provided, as well as I went ahead and included a PDF of the article itself, if you have not had a chance to download that or read that. We will take questions at the end of the presentation, so please type those in the question block so I can moderate them to our presenters. When I close the webinar, there'll be a short survey. We appreciate your feedback on this session, as well as ideas for future webinars. And then watch for an email follow-up. I think we're going to try to get that out yet tomorrow, with a link to the recording, the handout again, as well as the CEU certificate that you are earning with your attendance. So to get things started, I will introduce our presenters, who are also two of the authors on the paper. Dr. Pamela Roth-Puglia is an associate professor at Rutgers University, is interested in collaborative approaches to solving problems and creating positive experiences in health. And Lynn Fredericks is an author and the leader of Family Cook Productions, a nonprofit organization that develops award-winning, evidence-based teaching kitchen curricula for all ages, licensed in communities throughout the U.S. So I will turn the presentation over to them.
Thank you so much. So everyone can see this now, yes?
Well, we're also seeing part of the computer screen. If it can be in the...
Yeah, this is my mode.
Oh, I'm kind of seeing... I thought at one point we had it so that it was just the slide and not the rest of the screen.
That's what it's saying I have here, but this is... full screen. All right, that's better.
Yeah, that looks much better. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Thank you, Rachel. So these are the competencies that will be covered today, 5.5, 6.4, and 7.1. All right. So what is wrong with kids' food? Well, we could all probably answer that. Maybe we won't all have the same ideas, but let's think about that a little bit. So we're talking about the food that's really considered just for children and advertised and marketed just for children. So everything from breakfast cereals, a special kind of yogurts for kids, a zillion types of snacks, and even fish-shaped fish fingers. and of course, the ubiquitous burgers, nuggets, pizza, and mac and cheese, right? We see those everywhere. So when we look on the left, that's an example of some kind of nuggets. You see that those foods, they're more finger food friendly, more for kids to pick up with their hands, right? More homogeneous kinds of shapes. And they're going to taste pretty bland and probably a little salty, which is, we know, is addictive, versus what we see on the right, right? That would be hard for a child to eat with their hands. It would be kind of messy and gross to do that. Obviously, parents can cut up pieces, but still not quite the same. Plus, there's a lot of flavors going on there, and a little bit more challenging for young palates. When I started doing nutrition education over 25 years ago, I will tell you that, and we, you know, teach multicultural recipes, I was becoming increasingly alarmed because I saw a shift happening where we were teaching recipes for the whole family to enjoy, but where in the early on, I feel like the fight for parents around kids' food was to, you know, fight what they were being advertised to eat. And more recently, I realized that parents were actually believing and had kind of bought in hook, line, and sinker that, you know, when kids are little, they just eat different food. And that was really alarming to me. And I think we can all relate to that when you think about that wedding that you've been to and there's a sumptuous buffet and there's all these choices, but that's for the adults. And if you see that there's a whole other separate buffet just for kids, and what do you think they're offering? Those burgers, nuggets, pizza, and mac and cheese, right? So by about 2014, being so concerned about this, we thought about it here at Family Cook Productions, and we actually started a campaign around this topic. And we got some traffic, and we got some large organizations to sign on to it, and got some chefs to, you know, make small portions of their regular menu items intended for kids. But really, we didn't have the financial engine to move something along at the level that, you know, we really felt needed to happen in society. So I was looking for other opportunities. So I was quite excited when SNEB was looking for topics for position statements, because I thought, well, you know, why not suggest this one? And so we did. And it was accepted, which is really exciting. And I applied to be an author. And so we had a team leading under Pamela for this paper. And, you know, you can kind of see that if you really believe in something, even as one person, and yes, we have a little team over here at Family Cook, but, you know, you have an opportunity to, you know, make a bigger, through an organization like SNEB, to make a bigger change. So now we have this paper and this topic. So here we are looking at this, and what are the realities for people in society dealing with kids' food? So when we all go to a restaurant, very often we're looking for something a little different than what we cook ourselves all the time, right? Or what we're eating all the time. So sometimes we'll go to an ethnic restaurant of any type and look for, ooh, what are we going to learn? What are we going to explore? What are we going to taste? What's going to be different and exciting? Except when it comes to the kids' menu, right? Then what do we see when we go to the kids' menu? The typical things, right? The burgers and nuggets, the pizza and the mac and cheese. Even if you're at, you know, an ethnic restaurant, it still shows up. And that's when the game is over for parents, right? How do you fight as a parent this menu that's full of colorful things and the same things that their children are familiar with and they see everywhere and that they want? It's almost impossible. But this wouldn't be a problem and something that we would end up with a position statement for if there weren't serious consequences of this, right? So what is the problem of eating those same things everywhere? Well, clearly less variety, right? Because it's just burgers, nuggets, pizzas, mac and cheese, those kinds of things. But let's think about the quality of those kinds of items, right? Very often they're highly processed. It's a lot of salt. And they're just not, you know, the same quality of the other ingredients, maybe even being served in that same restaurant or in that, or what the parents are serving on the plates for themselves, right? The quality of the food that it's often designed just for children is cheap and it's not very good. And then because of the less variety, you don't have the span of nutrients, right, that you would be seeing somewhere else. So that is something that we need to think about when we think about why is it that this has happened everywhere? And there's some reasons that we're probably have thought about a little bit before. This idea of profitability, right? This is a fact that the marketers and restaurants and people make money because those items for kids, we said, are so cheap and inexpensive. They're always there, the same kind of items. They're everywhere. So we're all in this, you know, sick cycle where we can't get out because everyone, including parents, expects that that's what children eat. And it's actually everywhere, right? Because these are the items children see at school. This is what are being offered in the supermarket and very often at home on the table at home. So to break out of this is really, really difficult. And I'm going to let Pamela continue on with this story.
So when we started working on this position paper, I was very interested in learning, you know, learning about where did this social construct come from? You know, this kids from food archetype, where did it, you know, how do we get this idea that children require different, you know, there's a different menu, there are different foods for children. Where did it start? And honestly, I was surprised. It challenged my assumptions. I kind of assumed that it occurred during the 60s and 70s, during the Green Revolution, when there was a lot more food produced, and therefore inexpensive processed foods were created. But it actually went way, way back further than that. So Lynn, can you advance that next slide? So tracing it back, so we had the help of, just so you know how this was done, we didn't do this on our own. We had a medical librarian help us, and it was extremely, she's an author on the paper, and she was outstanding. And it was so interesting because she found a lot of literature that, as an academic, I had never read before. But it was such an interesting history to trace. And of course, this is how we think it happened. You know, it's historical, so who knows if it's exactly right. But in the late 1800s, there was a book about feeding children written by a pediatrician named L.M. Emmett Holt. And at the time, it was the only kind of, the predominant advice about feeding children. And in his book, it was widely used. It was the only source. If you think back to the 1800s, of course, there wasn't, the internet and social media and all the other ways that we get information. It was a book, and this was the book on children's feeding. You can find it online, by the way. It's really cool to read. It's very short. Won't take you a long time. But so he wrote this book, and in the book, at the time, it included some restrictions on certain fruits until the age of 5 and certain meats and vegetables until the age of 10. So we really did used to think that children needed different foods. That was because of, they had ideas about digestion and food safety and things like that. Prohibition rolled around, and during Prohibition, as you all know, in 1919, during the Volstead Act, alcohol was prohibited, and so the hospitality industry needed to come up with a source for lost revenue, and so they thought about it and they developed children's menus. And before Prohibition, it was very uncommon for children to go to restaurants, because of the cost, but also because it wasn't perceived as socially acceptable to have children around people who were drinking. So once Prohibition happened, then it became more acceptable for children to go out for dinner. And these children's menus were developed to offset lost revenue. And even there's even some evidence of a special menu, a children's menu by a restaurant trade magazine by Maud Colson that, helped sort of perpetuate that. And then later, Benjamin Spock's book was also kind of like the book on, raising children. And the recommendations in that were much closer to, the Academy of Pediatrics and our U.S. dietary guidelines. Next slide, Lynn, please. But, at the same time, In the 60s and 70s, during the Green Revolution, and this was a really, really amazing time in our history. It's when a person named Norman Borlaug, who won a Nobel Peace Prize, figured out how to grow more food in less expensive way. So we were able to learn how to produce a lot of food to feed the world. And in a very inexpensive way. In fact, we pay less household income on food than any country in the world. I mean, it's incredible. It's an amazing gift that we were given, right? It's complicated, but it also created opportunity for the food industry then to develop, really inexpensive foods, processed foods. And that's when you see the portion size increases and you see this explosion of processed food, all attributed to our ability to create inexpensive food. And then also at around this, around, you know, we also have more access to information, right? So we get our, so we can look on the internet. We're marketed. There's marketing, targeted marketing, particularly to low income and racial and ethnic minorities for a processed food. It's all protected by the First Amendment. And, you know, in advertising. So all there's all these confluence of circumstances that perpetuate this idea of kids menu, you know, cheaper, you know, inexpensive. Parents like that they can spend less money on a kids menu. So there's really no reason other than health for this construct to shift. Next slide. So despite, you know, public, you know, we all work in nutrition education. We all know how hard we work at improving health and diets and individuals, communities. But this myth prevails. I mean, if you ask, not everyone by any means, but if you ask people, what's kids' food to you? And they'll say chicken nuggets and french fries. It's just astonishing to me that that's what we think of as kids' food. So despite knowing that children do not need different foods than adults, other than adapting texture and portion size, they don't need different foods than we do. We just think they do. And so we have some ideas about this, about shifting this social norm. Oh, sorry, I'm on this slide too. So our position paper was just published in January. And it was really fun to work on for all of us. And it, you know, I encourage you to read it. It's not all that long. And you can find it. It's open access, so anyone has access to it. And you can find it in the link. And Rachel also mentioned that she sent it to participants in this webinar.
And there are a lot of references. So, you know, some of you might find some of the further reading from the references quite fascinating. So, out of this paper came some recommendations, which we're capsulizing here. The first one that I'm most excited about is, why don't we just not use the phrase anymore as nutrition educators, right? Let's just not talk about kids' food when we're doing our nutrition education, when we're talking to families, even as those of you that are dietitians, if you're doing counseling, don't have to talk about food being separate for the children. Can just talk about family meals and talk about the ways to adapt for portion size or texture for the children that are over 2 years old, and make this a real easy, because it's kind of a mind game, right? If you want to do a real paradigm shift. So by not talking about something, you're not reinforcing the idea. I mean, it's not going to go away right away, but you don't have to share that idea. And as soon as you say family meals, you're replacing this idea of what to feed children with what the idea of what the family eats. And right away, it connotates that the parents and children are also sitting together, which is another problem that can be very much associated to parents thinking that children eat different food. They can eat at different times, at different tables. It can get, you know, pretty crazy. So that is one. Rename it. Don't talk about it. Don't use that phrase anymore as nutrition educators. And I think this one is really exciting because we're a little unique in the United States because we have so many different cultures, right, that come together. So when we work with families that are coming from various parts of the world, and I know in some communities that's more of the case than others, there are ample opportunities to remind people that their own cultural heritage probably had lots of dishes that are reasonably healthy or very healthy. And let's explore, you know, what you were eating in your culture before you came here. Let's pick out the things that are most delicious and healthful for your family to continue to eat, and help people as they're acculturating and looking at, you know, what's available in the United States to eat, to think outside the box of burgers, pizza, nuggets, right? There's more than that. They can explore other cultures' foods because there's more and more of that food available all over the United States, and we can help them select what is most healthy and bring more variety to their whole family's diet. And I think that, you know, we have to ask ourselves this question: why is it that in America, children are eating these same, the burgers, the nuggets, et cetera, when if you go to France, some of the children 7, 8 years old are eating snails, right? In Mexico, they might be eating mole, which is such a complex sauce over their tacos. And in Iran, they're eating horesh, a stew that may have, you know, a dozen different vegetables and herbs all blended together. And there has to be a reason then connected to what we're feeding children in this country, to the fact that so many adults grow up and they don't want to eat their vegetables as they grow up, right? We really have an opportunity here to, sort of combine this idea of not talking about kids' food and talking about family meals and pushing people, you know, to identify opportunities to eat more variety together. Pam, this one's you.
Yep, thanks. So we know over time, societal understandings of issues become more narrowly focused around the most dominant and consistent messaging, right? We know that. That's something that's commonly, you know, that we're aware of. So the messaging is important, and how we message is important. And that's why Lynn talked about renaming foods. A simple thing like not using the term kids' food will create change over time. So again, you know, how we message and how we speak about things is important. It's a little small thing, but it's important. But it's also important to think about how these messages are framed. And in the U.S., or in, you know, Western cultures and the U.S., we have deeply ingrained values like independence, freedom, self-governance. And these are all, you know, admirable. And but an unintended consequence of these values is that failure is squarely placed on individuals. So when something goes wrong, it's an individual's fault. So think about it. Just think for a minute. When you hear HIV/AIDS, when you hear obesity, when you hear lung cancer, many people attribute the consequences, these consequences or these diseases, to individual failure. For example, if someone's overweight, we think they eat too much, they can't control themselves, they need to exercise more. But we all know, you know, everyone here is in or presumably are interested or in working in nutrition. We all know there are a whole bunch of factors that contribute to obesity beyond individual behavior, like the food environment. And that same thing goes for HIV and lung cancer. They're not entirely attributable to personal behavior because the causes are more complex. Yet we often default to personal failure because we tend because it's, you know, it's the way we think without even being aware of it. And proximal causes like diet and physical activity are easier to focus on. You know, distal causes like food environment, adverse childhood experiences, health inequity, structural racism, they're all part of the equation, but they're a lot more difficult to tackle. So we tend to just focus on individual failure. So, you know, and there's no doubt, you know, I'm still on this, the last slide, Lynn. There's no doubt that the proximal causes are more difficult to change, you know, and we know that trauma in childhood is related to obesity and other health issues in adult. But how are we going to tackle that? How are we going to tackle marketing processed food to low-income and racial and ethnic minority families? How are we going to tackle structural racism that perpetuates health disparities? I could go on and on. But there is some good news, though. So the good news, though, is that if we do think about how we attribute blame, right, how we attribute blame and frame our messages, we can have a big impact. When oftentimes when problems are framed as having a societal cause versus an individual cause, people are more likely to take collective action to solve the problem. In other words, if the problem like obesity is perceived as a personal problem, people don't respond because they think it's personal business. But if they understand that the problem is related to the communities we live in, the food environment, marketing, they're more likely to advocate for change. So we can think about these things and help to shift the way we attribute blame and frame our messaging as nutrition educators. The other more sort of sociological strategy, as opposed to some of the more practical strategies that Lynn was talking about, includes deliberately shifting our perception of risk related to the food environment. So I talked about the Green Revolution and our capacity to produce a lot of food and how lucky we are to have inexpensive food. But people aren't, you know, if we think of this as normal, people aren't going to change because the risk perception is very low. So just think about it. You know, if there's a natural disaster, people respond quickly and adapt quickly because the risk perception is really high. The same thing when you're diagnosed, diagnosed with a disease, many people will change a behavior very quickly because the risk perception is high. And we know this as nutrition educators because many of our behavior change theories are based on risk perception. But we may not think about how this social acceptance of kids' food downplays the importance of risk of eating processed foods. I think we need to make, you know, some noise about the risks of eating processed foods so that families and communities and society adapt and become resilient to the food environment. We have this food environment and we have not adapted to it. We're lucky that we spend less money on food, household income on food than the rest of the world. That's great. We're lucky, but we need to be adapting to the current food environment and becoming resilient to it and choosing healthier options, which may then shift consumer demand for products. Next slide now, Lynn. Thanks. So we can shift consumer demand, but how else do we go about changing the food environment? If you read the position paper, there's a lot of people working on this, in incredible work, innovative, impactful work. And I'm sure that we missed a lot because there are a lot of people working really hard in this area. There are some suggestions in the paper based on some of the themes that we found when looking at the literature. If you're interested in policy, become familiar with national and local food-related policies such as menu labeling and sugar-sweetened beverage taxes and things like that. Advocate for restaurants to join the Kids Live Well menu program and to improve that program. There's more information about that in the paper, too. If you're interested in research, there's an example. One of my doctoral students studied the differences in patrons' sugar-sweetened beverage consumption at Madison Square Garden and the Barclays Center in New York when Barclays implemented a voluntary 16-ounce portion cap on sugar-sweetened beverages. So it was a natural experiment, and she found that the Barclays patrons purchased and consumed significantly fewer sugar-sweetened beverages. And this paper was recently published in Preventive Medicine Report. So that's an example of something that may help us, and it's beyond individual, you know, beyond, you know, trying to change individual. That's a more community or society level intervention. And another example from the position paper that, you know, there are a bunch of them in there, but this one I found to be really interesting. The study examined over 38,000 menus and found that healthy food was significantly more likely to be described in less appealing ways than unhealthy food. So, for example, the unhealthy food was described as crazy, adventure, bites, and the healthy food were described as mild, plain, fit, nutritional. And so this is, you know, just one example of things that we can do to work with the restaurant industry, particularly since there are other studies also cited in the position paper that demonstrate that restaurant sales revenue does not drop when children's menus have healthier options. So we can leverage information like that to work with industry to help make our children's food options for children healthier.
So the paper is now available in your handouts, as well as these slides. And I'm excited to let everybody know that there is an infographic coming. Don't know exactly because it has to go through the board, but it is designed to quickly give you a tool to be able to share and get the word out and, you know, work on committees, not just within SNEB, but definitely outside, and follow through on some of these and share with other people what are some of the actionable things we can all do collectively to try to put the RIP, rest in peace, kids food, and move on from that. So I will stop sharing and we can take some questions. And I think that Rachel was going to field some questions.
Excellent. Thank you. If you have a question, please type that in the question block so we can moderate those to our presenters today.
I think what's a little bit different from this paper and this topic than a lot of things that have already been in literature, and it was a little, even though there are a lot of references in this paper, but it was a little challenging to find enough references on all aspects of this topic because we're talking about it being served everywhere, and there's not a lot of research on what's being served in the home.
A question, how do you deal with the fact that so many kids are used to kids' meals that they don't seem to want anything else? Have you found any studies or research about what strategies that parents can use?
I think that is one of the areas that's harder to find a lot of research, but I would offer a strategy of, I think it goes in with the naming thing, you know, parents can, if as educators, nutrition educators, we share this evidence that has existed for a long time as far as that they can eat the same thing, but that we're really calling it out there as what needs to be in our education very loud and clear to parents, that they simply can butt the, as in your family, you can be the one that decides what people are eating, right? And so I feel like where we can be strong with our advocacy and our education to parents to serve the same food, that will help change the children's perceptions. Yeah, they're still going to see the cereals and all that kind of stuff. But we can empower parents that this idea of there being separate thing is a social construct, right? It's something that we've all kind of bought into and that makes money for certain people. So that's great, but we don't have to continue to, you know, follow the myth. And I think as we empower, as nutrition educators, as we empower parents to see that this is not a fact, it's not true, that this is that they can eat the food that the parents are eating is part of the is the real task at hand for parents. I would say that that can help turn the tide over time. Do you have any thoughts about that, Pamela?
Yeah, I think, you know, so to this was a little beyond sort of the scope of our search, but I do know there is a lot there are a lot of interventions and research and programming around farm to table projects to help, you know, teach children about the origins of food and help them to, you know, sort of integrate that into their what they know as food and what tastes good and having them trying different types of food. So while we didn't specifically talk about that in our paper, there are definitely there's a lot of programming going on around that and school systems that have changed, you know, their menu, menus to healthier menus. And, so, you know, just because it's not, we're not talking about that now or in our paper doesn't mean that that doesn't exist. There's a lot of work being done in that area. And if you email me and if you, you know, can't access the, you know, a medical library or articles, just email me and I can help you find some of those, some things like that to guide you.
It's actually, you actually lead into the next two questions about, oh, there's several questions here about school food service. So, first question was, you know, what can we do to help school food service to get this across to kids since kids are eating so many meals in their school? And then Ashley Shimke wrote that she's working on a project called Create Your School Kitchen, working with 10 districts to shift more scratch cooking as soon as next year. And then her question was, what message or research have you observed in seeing K through 12 food service move away from, quote, kids' foods?
Yeah, it's such a great question, and there's a lot that's happening in that area. We didn't search about that, particularly about the shift in school lunches, but that's definitely happening.
I can share
kids are being exposed. Go ahead.
I can share a little bit about what's going on here in New York. We're such a large school district. We have over 1 million children, and we serve about 800,000 meals a day before the pandemic, less now, because not everybody's in school all the time. But I've seen a big shift to improve the ingredients and reduce, to a certain extent, some of the processing of ingredients that are available in school meals in New York. I've seen, because we have so many cultures here, I've seen a big effort to get to go to, they still have the burgers, the pizza, and the mac and cheese, but they have other things. And the efforts for like things like Meatless Mondays that are happening have created opportunities, exciting opportunities to introduce plant proteins to children and have things that are not just revolving around this, the meats that kids are used to seeing in those same shapes and forms that they've been getting for years. So that's been very exciting to see, and as well as there's been some efforts at, I guess I get frustrated when I see sometimes the efforts to change the component, right? Is it meat or a plant-based thing? But then it's a highly processed other kind of a nugget. That's kind of a downside of some of those changes. But I see a lot more recipes being offered to children because we work with school food pretty closely here at Family Cook. That are, you know, with chickpeas and other kinds of beans and things like that, that really don't identify at all with those same ubiquitous things. So children are, I think, are starting to see some new things, and people could be in touch with people here in New York, and I'd be happy to help anyone be in touch if they want more information. There's also a group, I can't think of what they're called right now, but if someone were in touch with me, I could find out. There's a group that's helping to guide school food services that the chef came from that restaurant in Denmark called Noma, but he's completely dedicated in a small, I think they're called Brigade, dedicated to working with school districts. So they work with our school district here, they work with one in Connecticut, and they're working with others around the country right now. I'm not sure where.
Question, did you say you had done a restaurant campaign to push this idea to restaurants? Ethnic restaurants offer such opportunities, great opportunities to get kids excited about healthy foods of different cultures, especially promoting vegetables.
Yes. Family Cook Productions did initiate a campaign. It's still accessible through our website called Kids Food Reboot. We actually got an article on the front page of the Washington Post about it, and we got some Washington area chefs to sign on and offer smaller portions at a lower price. So like a kids menu that was really celebrating what they normally serve at their restaurant instead of these burgers, fries, et cetera. And that was really exciting, but it's hard. It was a big reach for a small organization. So, you know, I'd be interested though in sharing some of the wisdom from that and some of the ideas that and resources that if someone wanted to pick up and start that, you know, relight that torch, we could definitely talk, and I'd be happy to, you know, share with a foundation that we were able to establish that.
Here's an interesting question. You may not have the answer to this, but maybe other folks could write something in the question block. What are examples of better foods that have been successfully accepted by children? Is there like a stepping, as a grandma I'm thinking too, is there like a stepping stone to move them off of what they're used to something, or is it just kind of rip the Band-Aid off and here's your new food?
I don't think there's a list of foods like that, but I think there is a strategy that we've found very useful. I discovered this as a parent before I was really doing nutrition education, but when we were talking about different cultures' foods, our American culture and maybe to a little bit some European culture tends to be have more traditional meals that are separating the protein, the meat over here, the vegetables over here, a starch, not every dish, but many. Most other cultures have much less of that. There's more smaller pieces. First of all, in most other cultures all over the globe, meat has been traditionally more expensive. So it's more of a condiment and it's not prominent in a particular dish, and things get all combined together in one pot or one in a wrap, you know, in a samosa, in an empanada, etc. And when that happens, it's very hard. I can tell you from my own children, I serve them all kinds of food and from every culture, and some they like and some they didn't. But when they wanted to take tomatoes out of their soup or whatever, I would say fine, because I knew that it was, you know, that made them feel that they were empowered, that they could do that. But I also knew that it was really like, well, if you want to take the beans out of the soup, like, good luck, you know, you want to take the beans out of the chili. I knew that they would, you know, there would be diminishing returns from that empowerment that I gave them. They wouldn't want to keep doing that. And that's what happens. By the third time, they do it to show you that they can, and they just eat it because it's too much work. So that's a strategy that's useful. But I don't know if there's actual foods that, you know, you can train their palate. I think the other thing I would say is that food that's exciting and really tasty. Eventually, children will start to appreciate that. They also like sour things. Children really like sour things. So that's something else to keep in mind with your lemons in your salad dressing is really useful for kids.
It's a tough conundrum. You know, if the child has developed a palate for the processed foods, it's a hard thing to deal with. And parents are busy and they're, you know, tired, and there's no question it's difficult. We do know, you know, from research that you have to offer things, you know, more than once for children to try them, you know, up to 7 times, actually, I think, for children to accept it. And that's also difficult as a parent, because who the heck has time or funding money to offer something for them not to eat? But there are a lot of, you know, people are working on this, and there are a lot of nutrition educators who spend a lot of time thinking about this question. So, you know, we've given, Lynn gave you some ideas, but there's also a lot of literature. There's a lot out there to help parents to make the shift, in changing their, you know, their children's diet, you know, to accepting more and a greater variety and, you know, more healthy foods that the parents are hopefully eating too.
And then, of course, there's the fact that if they're having a family meal that's shared and the parents are modeling that, we've seen in research that that is very effective for children to eat a wider variety of every type of food.
Yeah, the same with teachers. If teachers sit with preschoolers, they're more likely to have to eat the variety of foods too.
We have a comment that said from their experience having the kids involved in the cooking process helps them to be more open to trying the food. And we had another comment, as a mom of fourth and sixth grader, we never call it kids food. And I was clear that I cook one dinner for everyone with a good variety. So good job, Mom. Well, we've got time for more questions, but until I see another one pop up here, I'll go ahead and mention that obviously, this is a chance to talk to the authors of the position paper, but Journal Club actually starts on February the 7th, and that's another opportunity to hear from JNEB authors, and our spring series will be looking at various research methods. So please look at the SNEB website for those upcoming webinars. And then a reminder that the deadline to submit abstracts for this summer's conference is February the 14th, because SNEB loves research. There will be opportunities to present either virtually, or we are still working towards planning an in-person event in Atlanta in July. We do have virtual options available. So still planning, would still love to see everyone. But certainly, last 2 years of TOS, we have the flexibility to accommodate virtual audiences and needs as well. So encourage you to submit your research. Someone asked, where does the position paper go? Think it would be good to get a lot of press. I do know there was a press release written at the time the position paper was published, but we will, Lynn had mentioned that working on an infographic. So we will continue, obviously, to find other ways to help get this message out. And as she did mention, the position paper published in the journal is freely accessible to anyone, not just members. So if you, I think, Lynn, at one point you might have had the screenshot of the JNEB article up on the website. Feel free to direct your peers to that, to read that article, and because anyone can access this position paper. So
I have it here.
Well, that's another good idea that actually the press release, I was going to say, if you go to the JNEB website, in addition to the article, Pamela did do a author podcast along with the press release, and that's available. Lynn, do you have a chance to have the journal website up. I can show you where the podcast to listen to the author podcast.
It's right there. So the podcast is, do I go down?
If you scroll down on the homepage, there should be a, you should see Pamela's smiling face next to the podcast link. I think it's, that section says in the news.
Oh. Article. I'm on the.
Go to the homepage of the journal, not the article itself.
Oh, sorry. I see.
You're fine.
All right. So the journal.
Go to the go to the main page.
Now.
And scroll down a little ways, where it says there's, in the news.
Yes.
There's a link to the press, the article, the press release, and then the author podcast. And all of that's freely accessible to anyone as well. So definitely encourage SNEB members and everyone on this webinar to share that link. And let's get some more eyeballs on people understanding this issue.
Here's the podcast, I think.
That's the paper.
Yeah, I don't know why I'm not finding the podcast.
Oh, you had it up a second ago. Scroll back up where it says in the news. Up, 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 up. One more, right there.
Yeah, so you just press on the start.
Oh, it's up here. Okay.
Yeah. No. All right, well, I don't see any other questions, so we can close out the webinar today. Reminder that there's a short survey when I end the session, and we appreciate your feedback on this session as well as ideas for future webinars. We did record today's session, and we'll try to get that email sent out tomorrow. So you'll have a link to the recording as well as the handout, the paper in your CEU certificate for attending. And we look forward to seeing you soon on another upcoming SNEB webinar. Thank you.
Thank you, everybody.
Thanks so much, everyone.
Thanks, Rachel.
Thank you.